Hello, this is Orson Welles speaking. Next week marks the end of June. Next week marks the end of the OPA. In the better restaurants and hotels, the ghouls are celebrating already. For the profiteers, the battle's won. Right now, Sunday, June 23rd, to all practical intents, to all working purposes, the OPA is dead. The boom is on, friends. Just watch your dollar dwindle. And meanwhile, somebody is buying another senator another drink. Somebody's getting a congressman's wife some new nylons. One more week and the lid goes right off. One more week and the profits start piling in for the profiteers. All the profits they can hide from the tax collector. I mean, all the profits they can bury in the backyard. Now, I'm going down to Washington with some friends tomorrow to talk to the president about it. It says here in my crystal ball that the president is going to tell us that he, the president, hasn't enough support to do anything. We then will tell Mr. Truman that the people are behind the OPA, that that's where we would like to see Mr. Truman, behind the OPA, helping to push. But probably we'll just be making conversation. Mr. Truman is more pushed against than pushing. That thing his shoulder's leaning on ain't no grindstone, it's the eight ball. My little magic crystal shows some handshaking all around a dreary trip back to New York. Goodbye, Mr. President. Goodbye is right. I hope not, but goodbye. Some ugly stories are in circulation. I hear there's a deal cooking, a deal to keep price control on some food, on some rents, on some clothing, a deal to cut the anchor chains off everything else. I don't need a crystal ball, and you don't need a radio commentator to tell what that means. Before this, I've asked you to write letters to your congressman about the OPA, and you wrote the letters. I asked you to send telegrams. You sent the telegrams. As we stand today together, a helpless, hapless herd of taxpayers on the teetering brink of inflation, there's only one thing left to ask for. I ask you to go on strike. That's right, that's what I said. Let's go on strike. Let's walk out on higher prices and stay out until they stay down. We, the consumers of this country, are being played for suckers. Maybe we are suckers. Ordained suckers. By destiny and by nature, stuck with suckerdom. But like the man said, men sometimes are masters of their fate. The gold bricks aren't all bought up by all the people all the time. Even here in the darkness of the sheep run, we show a fitful flash of shrewdness. Those with eyes to see could spell out the words written in the sky over all those empty seats at the Yankee Stadium last Wednesday night. And these were the words. Not all of us are boobs. Not all of us are boobs. So, let's not pay a nickel more than anything is worth. Let's not spend a dime, a thin dime, a very thin dime. We don't have to spend. Not all of us are boobs, but the food and clothes and lots of fancy new products we'd like to buy are hid away from us, hoarded up in the hope of higher prices after the 1st of July. That stuff's going on the market sooner or later, and if the price zoom doesn't come off, it'll be sooner. Not all of us are boobs, but pretty soon it won't be easy to prove it. And what can we do before then? We the people, we the consumers, we can go out on strike. If the OPA goes off, how about buying absolutely nothing from the week of July 1st to July 7th? How about it? How does that sound? I'm sure it sounds crazy. But what could be crazier, if you please, than sitting back and letting a greedy ring of get-rich-quick experts pump the buying power out of your paycheck? Suppose there was a flood or a fire, some such disaster, and your town was cut off from food. Still, somehow, for a while anyway, you could feed your family. Well, inflation's a disaster, the real thing. It's a national calamity. Why don't we treat it like one, acting quickly and together? Why don't we just plain put our foot down? Why don't we stop buying everything for a week? The retailers won't like it, but they're not who we're shooting at. We're after the wholesalers. Let the wholesalers hear from the consumers. Something audible, something with threat in it. Then they'll start selling the stuff and at decent prices and in decent quantity. But of course, we consumers won't go on strike because we consumers aren't organized. And of course, if we were organized, we wouldn't have to strike. The truth has a dark and ugly face, and there's no point in masking it or trying to. Tomorrow, I'll pay the president that visit. And I'm afraid that after July 1st, we'd better all get ready to start paying for everything through the nose. Here's a letter. Dear Mr. Wells, it's now 3 weeks since my husband was laid off work at the button factory where he was employed for a month. While he was there, he wasn't exactly grateful for the long hours of hard physical labor without any breaks or rest periods. But now, after fruitless searching for another job, he realizes how fortunate he was to make $40 a week. He's a natural-born salesman, but unable for the first time in his life to sell himself into any kind of a job that pays a living wage. $30 is the top salary paid to returning war veterans, regardless of the size of their families. Although he's a skilled sheet metal worker, when he entered the Army, he's now told that his 5 years of service for his country set him back into the apprentice class in that trade. Mr. Wells, what are we going to do? The tragedy of our situation is that we're only one of thousands of veterans' families forced into such poverty. In this land of plenty, with its stirring productions, its new explorations in the fields of science, we can afford none of the new refrigerators or other marvels that will be rolling off the assembly lines within the next few years. We can't even afford shoes for our shoeless feet. Now the lid is blowing off the OPA, with prices in milk and butter and meat rising all the time. The big man, with all his power to wage strike wars against the worker, to paint the family man black for wanting a living wage, is taking the food out of the mouth of our very small baby, to be born within the next 2 weeks. Sincerely yours, Mrs. Ernest Schenck. That's a letter I got in the mail the other day. We've made it a custom on this program to read letters, and for the letters we use, we send a radio. So the lady who wrote the letter you just heard gets a radio. It's a very nice radio. I very much hope that what she hears on it in these next months will bring her happiness and encouragement. But she didn't write that letter to get a radio. I'm terribly afraid that she wrote for advice. Mr. Wells, she says, what are we to do? And I'm supposed to answer. There's a baby coming in 2 weeks. Her husband's been laid off work. His only chance is for less pay, and prices are going up. They're going way up. Mr. Wells, she says, what are we going to do? Well, last night, after the show, I put her letter in my pocket. And I went out on the town, it being Saturday night, and I sat at Toots's and at the store club for a while, and at El Morocco. I didn't get any younger. I didn't get any wiser. At dawn, I walked up to the plaza and watched the water and the fountain and the pigeons and the grass, alas, and tried to find a thought for the new day. But no thoughts came and no answers. No answers for a woman whose veteran husband needs a better job, who's afraid of what it's going to cost to feed her little baby. The last horse-drawn cabs in New York wait by the plaza these early summer nights till it's time for honest men to go to work. Lovers take the half-hour cruise around the park as late as sunup. And there's the occasional lonesome single like myself. I'm comforted by riding the park. When I'm in New York, I charter a carriage in all seasons, and I've made the half-hour cruise in many moods. Never mind about my mood this morning. Consider the condition of my cabbie. He being the dean of the drivers on the night shift, a worthy old warrior who last night lost a battle with a bottle. Surely his second. We'll call him Mike Anonymous. Well, Mike started off with me into the morning mists, carrying his own private fog along with him as he drove. For a time, I watched his jaunty silhouette under the topper and noted the sharp vapors of the essence of juniper. Then my attention wavered. It shouldn't have, for so did Mike's. The next thing we knew, we were climbing across a steep swatch of grass on our way to the statue of Daniel Webster. Liberty and Union, said Mike, waking from a deep dream of peace and reading the inscription on the pedestal. Now and forever, one and inseparable. Then all three of us looked up into the grim, graven features of the senator, all three of us being Mike, the horse, and me. We'd come close to a crack-up, but I was the more exquisitely startled because in that pallid light, and with a sick moon behind, fainting away into the morning, Mr. Webster's monument shocked back into memory an old, old bad dream. I had the dream often as a child. It concerned bronze statues, weathered green statesmen and poets collected in imagination from all the parks I visited, most of the countries of the world, solemn and sizable figures given in the dream to stepping down from their pedestals at sight of me and giving chase. I don't want to know how many sweaty, teeth-grinding nights I spent fleeing from all that distinguished statuary. I can still hear their metal footsteps tolling on the cobblestones of the nightmare. Dr. Freud and old Madge's gypsy dream book can explain this unpleasantness, however they may. I don't care what it means, and I'd hoped it was gone with the growing pains and the collie wobbles. But this morning, just as we charged full tilt into one of the real and original ogres, there was a giddy moment when I thought maybe the nightmare was prescience. And as a wreck seemed sure, the dread all hot and cold came over me that the old, old chase was over. Mr. Webster had caught me at last. But I was too quick for him. After much painful maneuverings, Mike and the horse and I regained the road and resumed our half-hour's cruise through Central Park. My own nightmare then put me into mind of Mr. Jimmy Cannon, the sports writer, who this week had a nightmare all over the front page of the New York Post. It was a newspaper story, but it read like Norman Corwin narration. Mr. Cannon was canonized for it in the New Republic. That highbrow weekly, in an eager flush of appreciation, is reprinting the piece in full as a striking sample of our current literature. Also, the New York Post has raised the author's salary and launched him on the syndicate. Now, the piece in question was a description of the Louis Kahn fight. And the Louis Kahn fight wasn't much of a fight, but it was an event with some sort of a beginning and a quite definite conclusion. And, well, here's how Jimmy Cannon, the sports writer, covered it in the only newspaper story on the front page of his paper. I quote, "Once dreaming with morphine after an operation, I believed the night climbed through the window of my room like a second-story worker. I thought the night had forsaken the world and shaped like a fat man walked through my face and up into my head," unquote. Mr. Cannon goes on like this for two full and full-blown paragraphs before we are informed that Mr. Lewis knocked out Mr. Kahn in the eighth, or as Jimmy put it, when Kahn fell off the rim of the conscious and crumpled into the dark privacy of the night he alone possessed. Mr. Cannon goes on like that for hundreds and hundreds of words. The editor, it seems, told Mr. Cannon to write just as much as he wanted. He did. Since his medium is the daily press, you might say it was too much and too soon. Over on page 60, he gets really good, though, and I mean really good, and I'm not being sarcastic. That's over on page 60. My kick with Jimmy Cannon has to do with page 1, since I'm an ex-New York Post columnist myself. He can call it sour grapes if he wants to, but I just can't go for that guff about the night crawling into Jimmy Cannon's brain, not on page 1. Somebody should take the purple ribbon out of Jimmy's typewriter. That boozy mist that does beyond the bogism is, for my dough, unworthy of page 1. And what's more serious, it's unworthy of Jimmy Cannon, because Jimmy Cannon is one of the best writers in America today. He has a keen, affectionate, and creative ear. He has the language ear. And that's a rare and precious gift. Damon Runyon has it. Ring Lardner had it, sports writers they were too. Read Jimmy Cannon, you'll see what I mean. If they don't run Jimmy Cannon in your newspaper, ask for him. You'll be glad you did. Last Monday, he wrote a column about Joe Louis. And in it, he said just this line, in a great column: "Joe Louis is a credit to his race. Naturally, I mean the human race." A man who can write a piece like that one shouldn't be bothering us with bad dreams about the night walking through his face like a fat man. Even if that's a good way to write a news story about a boxing match, what kind of a bad dream is it? Worst bad dream I can think of is just fighting one round with Joe Louis. Well, by the time these thoughts had found such organization as I've been able to give them this morning, the sun was up and we were coming at full trot back to the plaza. The day was already seeping in under my eyelids like a thin spinster with three eyes, like Swifty Morgan with a satchel full of snappy cravats coming in out of the rain. And while all this was going on, the letter from the lady whose veteran husband's paycheck isn't going to be enough for the baby they're going to have next week was burning a hole in my pocket. That's just what it was doing, burning a hole in my pocket. If Jimmy Cannon wants to find another, fresher phrase for it, he can have it, and the job of answering that letter. With my blessings. Now it's time to say goodbye. Thanks for listening. Please join me next week, same time, same station. Till then, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.